As Donald Trump speaks about terrorism today, we want to focus on two words you'll probably hear, Sharia law. It's become so scary to many Americans that lawmakers in some states have tried to pass laws banning Sharia law. Joining me now is Khalid Abu El Fadl, who's a professor of law at UCLA and author of Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to just start with the basic question. What is Sharia law?
At the very basic level, Sharia means the law of goodness. So it's very much akin to the basic concept of moral law or natural law. What is usually translated is Islamic law, which is the human extrapolations upon their understanding of the natural law of God or the moral law of God. Actually, when we talk about law of polygamy or we talk about law of jihad, we're really not talking about Sharia law. We're talking about Sharia law as extrapolated by subjective interpretations of human beings.
And what are some of the tenets of that that are true, and what are some of the misunderstandings?
Well, a very good example. One of the basic laws, one of the fundamental principles of Sharia law, the moral law, the natural law of Islam, is a prohibition against killing. Now, the way the human beings have interpreted that is that they have created many caveats, many exceptions. Some exceptions make sense, like the exception of self-defense, that you may kill someone if they're trying to kill you, and that's the only way you can preserve your life. But other exceptions have done horrendous things in life, like you may kill people if you think they're oppressing you, and you think that the only way you can get rid of this oppression is to strike whoever you want to strike, wherever you want to strike. The other thing that is very important to emphasize is that there is no code of law known as Sharia law. Sharia law is very much like rabbinic law in the sense that it is this massive corpus of interpretations and counter-interpretations and counter-counter-interpretations. In other words, it's a like an encyclopedic sea of opinions. And there is no church in Islam, so there's no definitive one source, institutional source, that can say, well, this is the law.
There's not a Supreme Court of Sharia,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why you see so many different Muslims that follow different laws than they believe that they sincerely believe that that's the truth and that's what's legitimate. Some of the interpretations are so extremely out there, so out of the orthodox mainstream, that it's fair to say that the vast majority of Muslims see them as corruptions of their religion. And I think that we can definitely say this about most of the stuff that ISIS does or Qaeda does. Unfortunately, you're talking about a system that's 1,400 years old, very much like rabbinic law, where there's thousands of sources and thousands of sages, each one with their own school of thought, with a lot of people that try to speak to outsiders as if it's a code of law and, you know, trick people into thinking that they're the voice of God within the Islamic tradition.
But where can you see Sharia law reflected in legal systems in the Muslim world?
Most Muslim countries don't apply Sharia law except in a very limited area, some personal laws and so on. The countries that claim to apply Sharia law are Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, depending on the subject matter. And the most ironic thing is that these two countries are also the two countries where you most contested on the Sharia front. In other words, I mean, if you ask me, I don't believe any of the interpretations of Saudi Arabia as the Islamic law are reasonable interpretations of the Quran, the tradition of the Prophet, tradition of the companions, the inherited opinion of the master sages. And I think you'll find a great deal of Muslims that feel the same way about Saudi Arabia. Same thing with Iran, and that's why a lot of Muslim dissidents that don't approve of the Iranian government. Part of what makes this picture complicated is that because of the lack of an authoritative, centralized, institutional, sort of a hierarchical system, there have been a great deal of self-interpretation by various dissident groups unhappy with which are mostly secular governments in power in the Muslim world, which were left over after colonialism. And a lot of these groups, like ISIS, like Muslim Brotherhood, although, of course, Muslim Brotherhood is ideologically quite different, unhappy with what they perceived as either secular governments or governments that kowtow to the interests of the West, and sort of went off and invented truly invented interpretive tradition. Unfortunately, in the case of many of these groups, they interpret from the raw medieval text some opinions of some of the earliest sages. And what comes out is without proper learning and proper training and understanding, you end up with very funny and bizarre results.
And in some cases, some things that people in this country have been very critical of, cruel of course, punishments, yeah. Stoning women accused of adultery or amputating the hands of people caught stealing. How common is that kind of capital punishment in legal systems with Sharia law? Or is it just, as you're saying, these outside groups, the Taliban, the Muslim Brotherhood, that do these kinds of things?
All of that is part of the medieval Islamic legal corpus. So stoning for adultery, amputating the hands of a thief, at the time they were extrapolated and articulated, they were unremarkable. All Near Eastern legal systems cut off limbs, and in fact, these were just regular criminal punishments. Now, these punishments have not been applied by Muslim countries for centuries, very much like Jewish law and Mosaic law and rabbinic interpretations. In that case, the sort of rabbis interpreted these laws in ways that made them unnecessary to apply. The same thing happened in Islam. So we don't have the last recorded case cutting someone's hand or stoning someone before Saudi Arabia came along, but hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
But you're saying now it is happening in Saudi Arabia?
Then suddenly we have this puritanical birth of a country like Saudi Arabia, which claimed it's going to go back to the medieval laws and apply them. I should say that Iran tried this thing about stoning and cutting hands of thieves and then discovered very quickly that it doesn't work in the modern world, and so they suspended all stonings and all severings of hands of thieves and replaced them with more modern criminal laws.
So what do you think then when there are places in this country and people in this country, like in Oklahoma in 2010, they enacted a law banning the courts from considering Sharia law in their decisions. What do you think of people in this country who are concerned that Sharia law could be applied here and could take precedence over the U.S. Constitution and that there need to be laws to stop that from happening?
To me, that's ridiculous at so many fronts. We would need to figure out what type of Sharia law are they talking about. Are they talking about Sharia law, Saudi version? Because if that's the case, I would be the first to die resisting it. I mean, who will allow Sharia law to take precedence over the U.S. Constitution? I mean, on the legal side, as a law professor, this absolutely makes no sense, because American courts will not apply a law just because the litigants want. My response, though, I understand the fear of dealing with people who want to return back time and go to a time that that is more cruel and less humane and reverse the achievements of human beings on the front of humanitarian thinking. And that is something neither I nor the vast majority of Muslims in the world can tolerate.
That's Khalid Abu El Fadl, who is a professor of law at UCLA. His book is called Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Professor, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.